Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. We begin with former President Trump's so-called hush money trial in New York. Trump once again held in contempt today for violating a gag order. Judge Juan Merchan said he'll consider jail time going forward.
This has never happened in this country before. It's a ridiculous thing, and I'm not supposed to be talking about it. But I am allowed to say that the judge has a conflict that, like, nobody's ever had before. You ought to take a look at it.
Merchan fined Trump another $1,000 for making remarks about the jury. That's in addition to the $9,000 he's already paid. The judge noted that the fine hasn't stopped Trump from violating the order. In a recent interview, former President Trump slammed the jury selection process, stating that most of the seated jurors were Democrats. The gag order bars Trump from speaking publicly about potential witnesses and many others who are associated with the court. After 2 weeks of testimony about the details of an alleged affair and a $130,000 payment, the focus in Trump's trial shifts today to the financial records. The Trump Organization's former controller and accounts payable supervisor testify. Our legal correspondent Arlene Richards has the details.
For the better part of the day on Monday, the Trump Organization's former controller and accounts payable supervisor testified about the records that are at the heart of the criminal case against the former president. The prosecution has accused Trump of falsifying business records to cover up the fact that he was reimbursing Michael Cohen for the $130,000 payment he made to Stormy Daniels. The prosecution laying the groundwork for the 34 charges in the indictment that say Trump mislabeled monthly payments made to Cohen as legal expenses. First up, Controller Jeff McConney. He testified that he learned about the so-called hush money payment when the former chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, told him they had to reimburse Cohen. Then McConney saw Cohen's bank statement showing the bank transfer to Daniel's attorney in the amount of $130,000. McConney said the payment included a $60,000 bonus that Cohen had been complaining about and a different $240,000 reimbursement. The payments were made in $35,000 installments over the course of 12 months. On cross-examination, McConney said there was a period of chaos after Trump became president, and the way they did business changed. He said he worked closely with Weisselberg and never spoke to Trump about the payments. But he confirmed to the prosecution that he was not privy to conversations Trump had with Weisselberg. He just did what he was supposed to do. Witness Deborah Tarasoff took the stand next. She is Trump's accounts payable supervisor. Tarasoff similarly reviewed invoices confirming that she made payments to Cohen at the direction of McConney, who she reported to. On cross-examination, she testified that she did not get permission from Trump to generate the checks. She relied on approvals from McConney and the CFO, Alan Weisselberg. Trump was the sitting president during the time that the payments were made to Cohen. Tarasoff testified that when the checks went out, she didn't know where they went, but when they returned, they were signed by Trump. Arlene Richards reporting from the criminal courthouse in Manhattan.
The White House is urging Hamas to, quote, come clean about its intentions after saying it's accepting a temporary ceasefire deal. Israel, accusing Hamas of trying to trick the public, has now begun targeted strikes in eastern Rafah. NTD's White House correspondent Iris Tao has the latest in the ceasefire talks.
Hamas said on Monday that it's now agreed to a temporary ceasefire deal brokered by Qatar and Egypt. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says Hamas's proposal is far from Israel's requirements, and an Israeli official told the Times of Israel that Hamas is playing, quote, tricks and games. The White House saying it's reviewing Hamas's response and also called on Hamas to come clean about its real intentions. Watch.
You know who hasn't answered a single question about his intentions and what games he might be playing or where he intends to take this? Mr. Sinwar, the head of Hamas. And I think it's high time that he answer some of these questions and he come clean about what his intentions are.
Israel, after telling civilians in parts of Rafah to evacuate, on Monday said it's begun striking Hamas terrorists in eastern Rafah. Netanyahu has vowed to go into Rafah and destroy the Hamas's battalions there with or without a ceasefire deal. But this morning, President Biden, in a call with Netanyahu before news broke about Hamas accepting a deal, and told Netanyahu that the U.S. opposes a Rafah operation.
Our support for Israel's security remains ironclad. And the president was consistent again this morning that we don't support ground operations in Rafah that would put the majority or even any of the civilians there at any greater risk.
And the White House, declining to go into details of the hostage deal, says negotiations are now in a critical and sensitive stage. Reporting from the White House, Iris Tao, NTD News.
And we have more updates on the Israel-Hamas war. The Israeli military is ordering people in Rafah to evacuate.
The Israeli military began dropping leaflets, sending text messages, and making phone calls in eastern Rafah on Monday, asking around 100,000 people to evacuate. The military included a map of designated humanitarian areas around Khan Yunis. Inside Rafah, Palestinians were seen dismantling their tents and fleeing.
We are dismantling the tent for the fourth time. We were displaced from the north to Khan Yunis. We are currently in Rafah facing displacement once again. We also fled to Jabalia. Now we're following the Israeli army's orders to move to the safe areas in Al-Mawasi in Khan Yunis.
The IDF said Israel is preparing a limited scope operation. Around the same time, the Israeli government kicked Al Jazeera, which is funded by Qatar, out of the country. Authorities confiscated broadcast equipment in Jerusalem, and they're removing the channel from cable and satellite platforms and blocking its websites. Israeli officials said the network promotes Hamas propaganda and poses a threat to national security. On Sunday, Hamas fired missiles on the Kerem Shalom crossing connecting Israel, Gaza, and Egypt. They targeted an IDF compound near the crossing and killed four Israeli soldiers. The border crossing is crucial for the delivery of humanitarian aid into Gaza. It remains closed for the time being. Reporting by Allison Lee, NTD News.
Chinese Communist Party leader Xi Jinping is touring Europe this week, his first visit in 5 years, amid strained relations over trade issues and the Ukraine war. NTD's France correspondent David Vives talks to a French senator about the goal of the visit.
Since the first day of Xi Jinping's tours in Paris, the French president seemed to be distancing himself from his Chinese counterpart. Rather than greeting him at the airport as protocol would dictate, Emmanuel Macron opted to meet him alongside the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, a move that appeared to prioritize the EU stance.
Xi's visit coincides with escalating trade tensions as the European Union investigates several Chinese industries for unfair competition.
Europe cannot accept market-distorting practices that could lead to deindustrialization here at home. But it is not good for Europe if it harms our security and makes us vulnerable. And this is why we act.
The EU Commission would also like China to step back from military support to Russia.
We've also discussed China's commitment not to provide any lethal equipment to Russia. More effort is needed to curtail delivery of dual-use goods to Russia that find their way to the battlefield.
The U.S. ambassador to the NATO military alliance said recently that Beijing had been selling drone technology and gunpowder ingredients to Moscow. In the past 2 years, China-Russia trade has jumped 64%, equivalent to $240 billion. Russian President Vladimir Putin is set to visit China later this month. In brief comment, Xi said he viewed his relation with Europe as a priority. However, the main takeaway of Xi's visit might not just be about trade relations. In a press conference at the Senate today, French Senator Olivier Cadic says the CCP's first secretary has geopolitical objectives.
The Chinese first secretary needs to keep the European Union as far away from the United States as possible in order to isolate the United States. It's easy to understand their whole strategy, which is to try and divide us. So he will try to convince President Macron to separate from the United States, be autonomous, to take him down that road.
After France, Xi Jinping will head to Serbia and Hungary.
These countries have close ties with Russia while talking with European neighbors.
His second strategy is to separate and divide us within the European Union. And it's no coincidence that I chose to go to Budapest. And of course, if he chooses to go to Serbia, it's only because it's one of the major candidates for membership of the European Union.
Xi will visit a South France city on the 7th and will then head to Budapest on the 8th. David Vives, NTD News, Paris.
A violation of human rights in Russia. The meditation practice of Falun Gong, also known as Falun Dafa, has been heavily persecuted in China since 1999. Now, Russia may be looking to deepen its ties with the Chinese regime by following its lead. We turn now to NTD's Jack Bradley at the State Department.
Russia is now the only country outside of communist China to incarcerate a practitioner of the spiritual practice Falun Gong, also known as Falun Dafa. It appears to stem from Russia's increasing economic reliance on China.
A Moscow court on Saturday sentenced 46-year-old Falun Gong practitioner Natalia Minenkova to 2 months in jail for her faith. This comes a day after Russian authorities raided the homes of four Falun Gong practitioners. Falun Gong is a spiritual practice based on truthfulness, compassion, and forbearance. Following the incident, Senator Marco Rubio said in a statement, quote, "Beijing and Moscow have for years undermined religious freedom as they actively target anyone who is simply trying to live out their faith." As the Kremlin continues to persecute Falun Gong practitioners, the international community must condemn these actions. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on Saturday at the Financial Times Weekend Festival in Washington, D.C., that the incident comes as no surprise.
Russia is increasingly relying on China for a lot of things, particularly as they have lost other avenues economically, technologically, and otherwise. So this is a relationship that we look at closely, carefully.
Executive Director of the Falun Dafa Information Center, Levi Browdy, told NTD the closer a country gets to the Chinese Communist Party, the more that country will try to appease them.
Going after dissidents of the Chinese regime, going after people who are speaking out against the tyranny of the CCP.
It remains to be seen how the U.S. will respond to China's spread of its persecution of Falun Dafa into Russia. This as China has increasingly been propping up Russia with economic and technological support. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Graduation canceled at Columbia University. The school announced it will no longer be holding its university-wide commencement ceremony. Only smaller school-based ceremonies will continue. This after weeks of unrest caused by pro-Palestinian protests. NTD's Fiona Ji has more.
According to Columbia University, the school consulted with graduating students before canceling the main university-wide ceremony. The decision comes after over 100 anti-Israel agitators were arrested last week after occupying and vandalizing the school's historic Hamilton Hall. Police will remain on Columbia's campus until May 17th. House Speaker Mike Johnson is now calling on Columbia University's Board of Trustees to fire President Manu Shafiq. In response to the anti-Israel demonstrations on campus, 13 federal judges are now refusing to hire any student or graduate of Columbia University. At the University of South California, police dispersed a second pro-Palestinian encampment Sunday. No arrests were reported. The University of California, Los Angeles, announced that the school will operate regularly starting today. This comes after classes were canceled last week due to anti-Israel protests that turned violent. At the University of Michigan and Northeastern University, commencement went ahead with increased security over the weekend. Other universities continue to face unrest. Students at Princeton University have begun a hunger strike. At New York University, over 5,000 alumni wrote to school administration, giving pro-Palestinian demonstrators their support. Harvard University warns that protesters will be put on involuntary leave. Protests have now spread to universities in England, France, and Italy. Protesters continue to demand that schools divest from Israel. Fiona Ji, NTD News.
And on Capitol Hill, two House committees are asking top D.C. officials and education administrators to testify this week about the campus protests. NTD's Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has more.
On Tuesday, Secretary of Education will testify before the House Committee on Education, and lawmakers are expected to grill Secretary Cardona on his testimony before the Senate last week and also on his response to anti-Semitism on college campuses.
That's the most important thing to me, to make sure that our kids are safe on campus.
Do you have people at Columbia right now on the scene to see what's going on there? Do you have staff there to watch?
I do not have staff at
Does the Civil Rights Office have somebody up there?
I do not have staff at the Columbia University.
On Wednesday, the House Oversight Committee will depose the mayor of D.C. and the chief of police of the District of Columbia regarding the encampment of pro-Palestinian protesters at the George Washington University and the alleged unwillingness of police to assist the university in removing unlawful protesters.
We want to follow the money trail to see if there are outside groups that are paying for these types of activity.
It is also expected that this week, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene will activate her motion to vacate the speakership, putting Speaker Johnson's leadership to a test. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
How will these protests impact President Biden and the Democratic Party? Earlier, I spoke to David Carlucci, Democratic strategist and former New York State senator. David Carlucci, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Now, as campuses erupt in pro-Palestinian protests across the nation, what does this mean for the youth vote? How big of an impact will it have on President Biden?
Well, I don't think it'll have much of an impact. Of course, a lot of people are pontificating about what this means. But if you look at the Gen Z vote in the 2024 election, you have 41 million eligible Gen Z voters, and you have only about 50 college campuses that have protests. And yes, these are very vocal and very animated individuals, but I don't think when you look at the overall percentage, and then you add to that polling that we see, and what are the top issues for young people, and this issue in terms of what's going on in Gaza is really single digits. And so I don't think it'll have much of an impact on President Biden, and particularly if he stays the course like he has done. He has said this will not impact his policy decisions as it relates to Israel and Gaza. So I don't think this will really have too much of an impact on President Biden.
On that note, President Biden's been telling reporters at the White House, quote, dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Now, today, Columbia University announced that it's canceling its main commencement event, and these are the same students who missed their high school graduation due to COVID. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's unfortunate, and it's really problematic when you see civil discourse bleed over to preventing people from participating in whether it's education or ceremonies like this. It is very unfortunate, but this is something we've seen, particularly in the age of COVID, where things like this have been canceled. So I think it's definitely unfortunate. But the good thing is these students are getting a degree, and that's the most important part. But overall, very few campuses have been disturbed when you look at the big picture of the thousands of campuses across the country.
And David, you're actually a former New York State senator. What's your view on the NYPD's response to these protests at either Columbia, NYU, or even the New School?
Well, you know, my heart goes out to our law enforcement because they're doing the toughest job there is, right? They want to defuse the situation. They want to keep people safe, and particularly those that are protesting, they want to keep safe. And I think overall, the overwhelming majority of protesters are doing it in a peaceful way, but there are a few bad actors and some that might not even be students that are disrupting and causing and trying to stir up violence. So it's very unfortunate, but I think the police, our law enforcement, are doing the best job that they can. And I think we have to give them credit for that. It's a very difficult situation, but I'm fortunate to be in New York, where we have one of the best law enforcement communities in the country, particularly in New York City.
Now, we've seen the Muslim and Arab communities in the U.S. taking a pretty big stand against President Biden. So far, we saw that uncommitted vote in the Michigan primaries. We've also seen growing calls of Genocide Joe in places wherever President Biden is going. Now, what is the best way for the president when it comes to moving forward this issue within these communities?
Well, he said this. Look, it's not going to sway him. He's doing what he thinks is best to bring peace to the region, and not just peace for a day, but long-lasting peace. And that's what President Biden is committed to, and I think he deserves credit for that, to not be swayed by some protesters that are really dogging him across the country. Wherever he goes, he's having that label thrown at him, which I think is very unfair. And I think it does a disservice to the movement that's trying to push for peace in Gaza, because when they throw things out there like genocide and Genocide Joe, I think it's just totally inappropriate, uncalled for, and it has no basis in reality. And that really disrupts their whole movement, because it's not a lack of credibility to be throwing out words as serious as genocide and putting that in with our president when there's no proof and nothing that it draws to that conclusion, I think is really sad and doesn't help the cause. President Biden is doing what he can to bring peace to that region. And I understand that people are frustrated, but that's where it stands. It's frustration, and not like standing out or sitting out on this election is going to help their cause at all. There's a binary choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And you have to ask yourself that serious question of who's going to be better on the issues, particularly this issue, for them.
On that note, what about the Jewish vote? We've seen since the 1960s, the majority of the Jewish vote has gone to the Democrats. Do you see that changing or staying the same?
Well, I think that has evolved over time. You see more and more, particularly in the ultra-Orthodox community, rallying behind Republicans. But I think it's anyone's game there. I think the Jewish vote is one that has to be courted, like many others. And politicians have to earn that vote and not just take it for granted. And I think that's what you see. I think Democrats and Republicans are jockeying for that vote, and they have to deserve it. And I think President Biden, when you look at what he's done, particularly to combat anti-Semitism, he's not just talking the talk, he's walking the walk. And I hope that those actions will reverberate to the community to see what's really happening, and that they will stand behind him in taking those actions.
David Carlucci, thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some of today's top headlines. The judge in former President Trump's hush money trial ruled that Trump violated his gag order a 10th time and fined him $1,000. The judge threatened to give Trump jail time for future violations. Trump was in court for the third week of the trial. Jeff McConney, former controller and accounts payable supervisor at the Trump Organization, testified about the business records that are at the heart of the case. The Israeli military ordered around 100,000 people to evacuate from eastern Rafah. The Israeli Air Force began bombing Hamas targets in Rafah in preparation for the planned ground operation. The Hamas terrorist group said it is agreeing to a six-week hostage and ceasefire deal. The Biden administration says Hamas needs to come clean about its intentions. And Israel said the deal that Hamas agreed to is not the framework that was agreed upon with mediators. Joining me now to discuss these latest updates in the war is Middle East Affairs analyst Gerard Felitti. He is also senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. Gerard, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you again. Now, Hamas has accepted the latest ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar, while Israel says it's unacceptable. Now, Hamas made this announcement shortly after Israel ordered evacuations for parts of Rafah. How do you read the timing of Hamas's move?
The timing is very suspect, and what we're learning now is that what Hamas seems to have accepted or agreed to is not the proposal that had been on the table 10 days ago that Israel had agreed to. In essence, Hamas is making it up as it goes along. It is inventing its own ceasefire agreement and then accepting it, putting pressure on the Israeli government and on the United States to put pressure on Israel to agree to a ceasefire or else look bad in going into Rafah. So this really is a clever political move by Hamas to build sympathy among Western powers, but it is not a true ceasefire because there was no meeting of the minds. There was no agreement onto terms. Hamas is literally making it up as it goes along.
Expanding on that, some analysts say that it is a calculated strategy on the part of Hamas to increase pressure on Israel, both from the international community and families of the hostages. Would you agree with that?
I do. We've seen throughout the Western world and even now on American college campuses, on city streets, the Hamas political wing has been very successful in mobilizing young people and not so young people to take to the streets and try to put pressure on the Biden administration or on other Western countries to stop supporting Israel, to condition aid to Israel, and to build sympathy for what is going on in Gaza. This is also putting hostages at risk because there are no meaningful negotiations to obtain their release. And it's putting pressure on Netanyahu's government to take more decisive action to secure the release of hostages, more likely than not through negotiation. So the crux of the matter is all of this is calculated by Hamas to put Netanyahu's administration in a bad light so that it caves to Hamas demands.
And what do you see as the role of Egypt and Qatar in this latest development?
Egypt and Qatar have been fairly reliable at providing back channels and negotiations. However, at this point, they're being used as much as everyone else by Hamas. Hamas is at a stage of desperation where they do see their last foothold in Gaza, in Rafah, being threatened. We know now that a few hours ago, IDF tanks started going into Rafah, and Hamas is desperate. So they are, if anything, they are risking their credibility with their Egyptian and Qatari counterparts by inventing ceasefire agreements that don't exist. It's their credibility that's at risk, and it also makes Egypt and Qatar look bad because what they're vouching for is something that never happened.
To your point, an IDF spokesman said that the Israeli Air Force attacked more than 50 targets in the Rafah area today ahead of an expected ground operation. Now, Palestinians have been fleeing the area, fearing an Israeli assault. How do you think the international community will respond to all this?
The international community is concerned, and quite rightfully so. There is a lot of devastation on the ground in Gaza. There are so many civilians that have been impacted by this violence, and there is legitimate concern that there's not enough food, not enough medical supplies, and just increasing violence that doesn't seem to end at all. So the international community is looking at the situation. They want humanitarian supplies to be in position. They want the Palestinian people in Gaza to have basic necessities and services. But that's simply not happening because Hamas is continuing this war of aggression. They are not releasing hostages. They are not surrendering the leadership that caused the October 7 attacks. And Hamas itself is leaving its citizens in a position where they are at risk of death from this war.
Expanding on that, a statement from the Prime Minister's office reads, "The War Cabinet unanimously decided this evening Israel will continue its operation in Rafah in order to apply military pressure on Hamas so as to advance the release of our hostages and achieve the other objectives of the war. Now, should Israel push ahead to achieve its objectives, even if the U.S. disagrees?" What are your thoughts?
I think it's very likely that Israel will disregard whatever opinion the United States has and do what is in the best interests of its citizens. That's what a government is meant to do. It's to protect and assert the rights of its citizens and not worry about international opinion. Now, more to the point, you have a war cabinet that's a compromise that has opposition leaders in it as well. This is not a political cabinet, but rather one that is comprised of a wide swath of Israeli society. So what this is really saying is that the Israeli people are unified in wanting to secure peace and freedom from the terrorist aggression that is Hamas. So this really speaks to the Israeli government's need to continue operations until it has done what it set out to do, which is make Hamas powerless, to render it inoperable for any future attacks.
Gerard Felitti, Senior Counsel of the Lawfare Project and Middle East Affairs Analyst. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In more international news, U.S. officials say an American soldier has been detained in Russia since last week. He was reportedly stationed in South Korea and traveled to Russia on his own. Moscow authorities accused him of stealing from a woman and arrested him on charges of, quote, criminal misconduct. The U.S. Army said his family has been told about the situation and the State Department is working to provide consular support. The soldier is just one of several Americans who are detained in Russia. Millions are bracing for severe weather this week as some are still recovering from disastrous weather the week before. The stormy weather over the weekend wreaked havoc in the Midwest through Texas.
Millions of people in the central U.S. are bracing for powerful storms Monday, including long-track tornadoes, hurricane-force winds, and baseball-sized hail. According to the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center, much of Oklahoma and parts of Kansas are at the greatest risk of bad weather. Areas in Oklahoma, such as Sulphur and Holdenville, are still recovering from a tornado that killed four and left thousands without power last week. Both the Plains and Midwest have been hammered by tornadoes this spring. With the forecast, Oklahoma City Public Schools and several metro area school districts began canceling all after-school and evening activities. The last time a high risk was issued was March 31, 2023, when a massive storm system tore through parts of the South and Midwest, including Arkansas, Illinois, and rural Indiana. The entire week is looking stormy across the U.S. The eastern U.S. and the South are expected to get the brunt of the bad weather through the rest of the week. In Texas, a child died after being swept away in floodwaters north in the Fort Worth area. Hundreds of people have been rescued from flooded homes and roads. Over the last week, areas near Lake Livingston, located northeast of Houston, have gotten upwards of 23 inches of rain. In California, the spring storm over the weekend drenched the San Francisco Bay Area and closed Northern California mountain highways. It also set a single-day snowfall record for the season on Sunday in the Sierra Nevada. According to the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab, the snow dropped about 26 inches of snow, making May 5th the snowiest day of the season at the lab.
Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. For years, the high-speed bullet train in California was in the public eye, expected to transport people from San Francisco to L.A. President Biden even called it the most ambitious rail project in the Western Hemisphere. But the rail agency is now facing criticism over its recent celebration of its progress. NTD's David Lamb has details.
California's bullet train is supposed to be the first ever high-speed rail system in the U.S., but it's taking heat again. California High-Speed Rail Authority was celebrating Infrastructure Month. One of the sites highlighted was a 1,600-foot Fresno River Viaduct, completed in 3 years in 2018. Elon Musk and Dogecoin creator Billy Marcus mocked the rail system's progress. Marcus jokingly said it takes about 5 minutes to walk 1,600 feet, so a high-speed rail for that is a really big deal. California is so competent. And Musk posted a sad, crying emoji. Politicians recently got an inside look at the rail system.
To see the project, get the feel of it, I think it is always helpful, especially when you make such a large investment as a state, to kind of see, touch, and hear, you know, that the project.
But there's been concerns over whether the entire project will be completed after more than $11.2 billion taxpayer dollars were put into it since 2006. The electrified bullet train is California's project to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles, with the train expected to travel up to 220 miles per hour. It was awarded $3.3 billion in new funds by the federal government in 2023. According to the CEO, the Rail Authority is making progress toward operations, including construction, design for project extensions, and procurement of train sets. David Lamb, NTD News, California.
And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, a busy weekend in sports, but let's start with the Kentucky Derby. Mystic Dan was the winner Saturday in a three-way photo finish. Will we get a rematch?
You know, that's the big question now. You know, this is the first leg of horse racing's Triple Crown. The Preakness is next, but that's in just less than 2 weeks. It's a very quick turnaround for this. Mystic Dan's owners have not committed to this race yet. Who knows if they will, but it would be hard to top this one, with Mystic Dan finishing winning by a nose over Sierra Leone, who was just a nose ahead of National Treasure. It took several minutes to actually sort out who won. I mean, it was a photo finish. The race, meanwhile, drew a huge TV audience, too. 16.7 million viewers, that's the most in 35 years. And, of course, a lot of money switched hands. $210 million, that's a record bet on this race. As far as a rematch, we might have to wait until the Belmont Stakes, that's on June 8, to have this race again.
Over in baseball news, today is actually the anniversary of what some consider the greatest pitching performance ever, Kerry Wood's one-hit shutout where he struck out 20 batters. Why is this ranked ahead of some perfect games?
Yeah, I mean, a perfect game is obviously very special, but it doesn't actually depend on the pitcher striking out any batters. Literally, the defense can do some of the job. The real test of how dominant a pitcher is how much contact the batters are really making. And on this day 26 years ago, very few of them did. Wood's 20 strikeouts that day tied the record for the most in a game. That's something that's been done just 5 times. Meanwhile, there have been 24 perfect games, and he really made the hitters look silly. They knew it was coming. They still couldn't hit it. The 20 of the 29 batters were struck out. He didn't walk anyone. He had one hit, but there was really, you could have called it an error. It hit off the glove of this guy and was good for a single. Even more amazing, Wood was just 20 years old at the time. He was a rookie. This was just his 5th career start. He won Rookie of the Year that year, but unfortunately, a major injury knocked out his whole next season. And he was a 2-time All-Star, but never actually won a Cy Young. But for that one day, he was the best ever.
Moving to women's basketball news, StubHub is reporting that ticket sales for the WNBA are almost double what they were last year. Do you attribute this to Caitlin Clark?
Yeah, I think a lot of it can be attributed to her. I mean, we just saw the women's NCAA title game, which she starred in, get better TV ratings than the men's for the first time ever. Plus, her last 3 collegiate games each successfully broke women's viewership records. Even her WNBA preseason game last week was a sellout. This is in Arlington, Texas, and it was just 20 miles away from where the Dallas Mavericks were playing the LA Clippers in Game 6 on the same night. Her draft night jersey even set a record for most sold on draft night, and that's over all sports, you know, men's included, so she's got quite a following. But I also think another incoming rookie, Angel Reese, has added some interest too, over 3 million followers for her on Instagram. So this could be what the WNBA has really been waiting for.
Over in NBA news, the playoffs are in the second round now. What do you see as some of the better matchups?
You know, I think Denver versus Minnesota is the most intriguing matchup for me anyway. And this is the only one that's actually started with Minnesota taking game 1 on the road on Saturday. Now, Minnesota presents some matchup problems by essentially starting 2 centers. One of them is Rudy Gobert, who's a 3-time defensive player of the year. But Gobert is actually questionable for tonight's game. He actually became a father for the first time earlier today. But maybe the bigger question is, who on Denver can slow down Anthony Edwards? I mean, this guy is really a budding star. He's like a basketball player in a football player's body. 6'4", 225 pounds. He scored a game-high 43 points in game 1. If Denver is going to repeat as champion, they're going to have to figure out something for him. Now, tonight, we've got game 2 of that series. We've also got game 1 of the Knicks versus Pacers series. That's an old rivalry renewed, and that starts up tonight.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tiff.
As Shenyang Performing Arts ramps up its 2024 season this month, it's still moving audiences around the world. Over the weekend, the New York-based dance group gave 18 performances in 6 cities around the world, taking audiences on a journey through ancient China. A Mexican writer called Shenyun spiritual food to mankind and added that the world needs more of a performance like this to save human values.
Magical. The colors, gold, blue, red, silver, are extraordinary. It bursts out like flowers, like a bouquet of flowers, or like fairies, a painting of fairies. It's all beautiful. It's bursting with color. It's really good, and the music is exceptional.
The live musicians along with the live dancers, and then also the film on the back of the stage is just amazing. It's all coordinated just beautifully. Traditional music and the instruments brings it all together. It sounds very, very authentic.
The costumes, the dances, it's beautiful, but it also has a very profound message about communism and what we need to start looking out for here, because it can very easily happen to not be able to practice your religion or think freely because you're afraid. It's very sad. But they find a beautiful way to present it.
Shenying's mission is to revive 5,000 years of divinely inspired culture and values from before communism. Theatergoers have been deeply touched by the effort and also took note of a deeper message.
I'd really like to see us adopt the philosophy you presented to us for a better, more peaceful world. And today I'm calm because I've seen a lot of goodness this afternoon, a lot of Zen.
All the dancers and musicians in this symphony orchestra are people of high moral character. The artists have worked hard for many years. They are perfectly trained. The performance gives nourishment for our spirit, but also has a very important goal: to rescue the human spirit from the claws of the Red Dragon.
Bring the culture back to what it was, I think it's fantastic. Because everybody, I mean, history is very important to every culture, not just the Chinese culture, but our culture as well. And making people aware of what has happened also prevents, hopefully in the future, mishaps happening again.
Audience members value the opportunity to learn about true traditional Chinese culture, and many said sharing is more than just a performance.
And the great thing is that this Xinyun performance is not just a cultural performance. It transcends the cultural into the spiritual. I sincerely hope that there will be more and more performances like this. In fact, there should be more performances like this that save traditional human values in the face of the destruction of our values, customs, and religions.
Honestly, all humans on Earth should have the chance to see this perfect, beautiful, and magnificent performance. It brings emotions together with art. I thought it was divine.
Shenyun's 2024 World Tour will continue until May 11th. NTD News, New York.
And that's all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.